Daily news and analysis. We keep you informed and inspired.
This is World Today.
Hello and welcome to World Today. I'm Zhao Ying. Coming up, Chinese President Xi Jinping calls for more cooperation with the Federated States of Micronesia. How will the collaboration benefit both sides? China says it's regrettable to see Fitch Ratings downgrade the country's sovereign credit rating outlook. We discuss more on China's long-term economic health. And UK employees now have the right to request flexible work from day one. What changes will it bring to the workplace? Chinese President Xi Jinping has called for more cooperation with the Federated States of Micronesia on building infrastructure and tackling climate change. He made the remarks while meeting with Micronesian President Wesley Simina in Beijing. Simina is on a state visit to China until Friday. Gao Yiming has more.
President Xi says China supports Micronesia in safeguarding its national sovereignty and independence and taking a development path suited to its national conditions. 2024 marks the 35th anniversary of bilateral ties. Xi Jinping says China is willing to advance relations with Micronesia. He called on the two nations to speed up cooperation under the Belt and Road Initiative and strengthen exchanges in culture, health, and education. The Chinese president also welcomed more young people from Micronesia to study in China. President Xi said China is willing to provide climate change assistance to Micronesia within the framework of South-South cooperation. He also hoped the two sides can pursue multilateralism by strengthening cooperation within the United Nations and the Pacific Islands Forum. President Simina expressed his willingness to deepen collaboration with China in fields such as agriculture, fishery, tourism, and addressing climate change. Simina said Micronesia acknowledges that Taiwan is an inalienable part of China's territory, and it supports China on issues concerning its core interests, such as Taiwan, Hong Kong, Xinjiang, and Xizang. He hailed China's cooperation with Pacific Island countries conducive to regional peace and development. Micronesia vowed to continue promoting such collaboration.
That is Gao Yiming reporting. And for more, we are joined by Dr. Digby James Ren, Senior Special Advisor and Director of the Mekong Research Center at the International Relations Institute of Royal Academy of Cambodia. President Xi mentioned a comprehensive strategic partnership between China and Micronesia. What does that say about the relationship between the two countries?
Well, the two countries have got a long relationship, more than 35 years. That's one of the reasons, of course, that they're meeting to celebrate that fact. But it hasn't been always smooth. But it's overall, it's generally the trend that the islands are seeking. And so I think there's really something to celebrate in that.
Yes, but we know that actually this meeting comes after a period of strain between China and Micronesia over the past several years. So does this meeting signify a renewed commitment to the cooperation between the two countries?
Well, I think that's true. There's a renewed commitment to development in the relationship. An economic development related partnership. And because it's been going for a long time, look, China has built an enormous amount of trust. So it's not as if that's just going to disappear. And one has to remember that there's a lot of external forces operating to try and destabilize that relationship. And I think over the last couple of years, they might have had some success doing that. But look, I think this is going to put everything back on the right track.
Yeah, and President Xi said China supports Micronesia in safeguarding its national sovereignty and independence, following a path of development in line with its national conditions. How important is this commitment, particularly given the big power competition in the Pacific region?
Well, I think what President Xi is pointing to here is that every country needs to be able to take control of its own economic development and be able to choose with whom it wants to operate. And, you know, what's best for the material well-being of their populations. And clearly, in the current great power environment, China offers much more through its trade and its exchange programs and infrastructure building and all sorts of other supports that are available to these countries. And they understand that China is really fundamentally about economic development and win-win solutions between sovereign countries. And I think the islanders, and specifically Micronesia, but other islands, also believe that more and more. And that's evidenced in the fact that more and more of these islands are interacting and cooperating and joining the Belt and Road, for example.
Yeah, and President Xi said that China's engagement with Pacific Island countries is based on mutual assistance within the framework of South-South cooperation, which is neither targeted at any third party, nor should be interfered by any third party. So how do you interpret this statement?
Well, I think this is clearly the trend and the desire of most, and if not all, countries in the global majority and in South-South cooperation, and that is the definite trend. And for all of these little islands, small islands, very isolated islands in the Pacific Ocean, this becomes so much more important to be able to have a network, a framework, a multilateral network framework where they're free to be able to interact with all of the other nations that are very similar to them.
Yes, and President Xi also emphasized cooperation in various fields, including infrastructure projects, people-to-people exchanges, and education. How will cooperation in these fields benefit both countries?
Well, clearly, the greatest problem for a lot of these islands has been the colonial paternalism that was exerted upon them by the Americans, the French, and, you know, the Spanish way back. But in the last 50 years, that's really been the Americans and the Australians, and so there's been a lot of cooperation already in relation to fishery, agriculture. You know, agriculture is a very large problem for small islands. Trade and investment that's required, building infrastructure like government buildings and schools and hospitals, tourism. And of course, when you're at distance like this, China's leading the world in kind of digital and cross-border transactions and trading and things like that. And when you're on an island, that's essential. So the digitalization is really good. And then fitting into a much larger framework, for example, the Belt and Road, where you can have multilateral connection and trade and investment connections to a much wider group than ever before. And this is what, you know, China is basically helping to facilitate for these islands.
Yeah, and climate change was highlighted as a key area of cooperation. And President Xi said China is willing to provide assistance to Micronesia in addressing climate change within the framework of South-South cooperation, as well as capacity building. So what specific measures do you think are needed to address this pressing issue for Micronesia?
Well, clearly the islands and Micronesia in particular, they don't have enormous resources, not really. I mean, they've got ocean and possibly the things that are under the ocean, so minerals or something like that. Sea grasses and fish, obviously, these things are all in their waters, but agriculture is very difficult, and rising waters is a pressing problem for all of the islands. So climate change, how to address that best, and that's where China leads the world in renewable energy supply, in electrification, green development, healthcare, sustainable infrastructure and development cooperation within the United Nations sustainability and development goals, and within the frameworks that the islanders have established for their own development. You know, what they really need, not what what some other country is just willing to give them to keep them lined up, you see, which is what they've been doing for the last 100 years.
Yes, and President Xi also underscored the importance of multilateral cooperation within frameworks like the UN and the Pacific Islands Forum. But how might China and Micronesia collaborate effectively within these multilateral platforms?
One of the greatest blocks for the development of emerging economies or microeconomies like these Pacific Islands, we need to think of them as micro. Very few of them are very large, Fiji perhaps and Papua New Guinea, but the others are really all micro states, very small populations. And so what they get a voice in these multilateral cooperation frameworks, and they get consensus building, which is something they're not used to, you know, having lived in the colonial yoke for, you know, more than 100 years. So that's the first thing, giving them frameworks and cooperation mechanisms and alignment with their friends and their neighbors and extending their possibilities for a capacity upgrading and so forth within these forums. It's very useful. It gives them a more powerful voice. But just saying all of that, there is also frictions in the between the islands, and they need to be managed very carefully. And that also can be done in multilateral platforms.
Yeah, but there's another issue that I like to ask, because it is reported that the United States is considering military projects across the Federated States of Micronesia, including a significant airport upgrade. So how might such increased U.S. military presence impact Micronesia's relations with China, in your opinion?
None of the islands and Micronesia, they want upgraded facilities in terms of airports and ports and so forth. But we can see the difference here. The United States is militarizing everything, spending their money into, you know, non-productive assets. You know, so what happens in the islands is, you know, they get a certain amount of money from the Americans every year to maintain the military base. But that's not productive. You see what I mean? They're not actually producing, selling, or trade and investment. It's virtually useless for these countries. And so I think, you know, we know what the long-term plans of the Americans are, and that is to stop any of these islands, you know, having their own sovereignty, control over their own borders, economic zones, and even over their defense and international relations. And, you know, this is really a hegemonic colonial hangover, and I think everybody can see that China offers a much better solution.
Okay, but there are some concerns within Micronesia that the country might be stuck in the crossfire of bigger countries. How do you look at such concerns?
Well, I think they might already be in that situation. It's a sort of an unavoidable thing. The only way that they can really maintain their own autonomy is to think, you know, and cooperate together on a consensus-based forums and address their real problems about climate and investment and trade and having export industries and upgrading education and health and offsetting, you know, with renewable energy. That's where it's all at. And of course, the militarization of the Pacific Islands won't provide any of those things. And one can only be hopeful that the islanders, now that they understand that there are options, many options, other than just militarization and colonial hangovers and paternalism in the islands, I think they need to, you know, China is a shining example for them. It's economic development. It's not about just turning it into a military base that, you know, has no productive course for them. So I think Micronesia is really setting the course again, and I think we're going to see more of the PIF, Pacific Islands, thinking very clearly about the opportunities that are offered by China, economic growth, real development, win-win, consensus-driven, multilateral platforms, as opposed to militarization and, you know, veto power over their sovereignty. So I think China's on a winning path doing this and should maintain that path. It's very patient, slow, and concentrates on supporting economic development. That's a win-win.
That's Dr. Digby Wren, Senior Special Advisor and Director of the Mekong Research Center at the International Relations Institute at Royal Academy of Cambodia. You're listening to World Today. Stay with us. You're listening to World Today. I'm Zhaoying. China's Ministry of Finance says it is regrettable to see Fitch Ratings downgrade the country's sovereign credit rating outlook. The agency revised its outlook from stable to negative. The ministry says the agency's rating system failed to effectively reflect the positive effects of China's fiscal policies on boosting economic growth. It says the plan to keep China deficit to GDP ratio at 3% is generally moderate and reasonable. The ministry says the plan will help stabilize economic growth, control government debt levels, and reserve policy space for potential future risks and challenges. For more, we are joined by Liu Zhiqin, Senior Fellow of Chongyang Institute for Financial Studies at Renmin University of China. Professor Liu, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So Fitch's decision to downgrade China's credit outlook was based on concerns about the country's widening fiscal deficit and rising government debt. But China's Ministry of Finance argues that Fitch's methodology failed to take into account the positive role of China's fiscal policy in promoting economic growth and stabilizing the macro leverage ratio in a forward-looking manner. How do you look at this?
Yeah, in my opinion, I think We don't need to take too much care about the such rating or downgrade of China's sovereign the debt rating, because Fitch is only a company that is making its own study or research on the different ratings. Because in the history, we know this company has downgraded many major countries, advanced countries, sovereign debt rating. So this is something that more professional and also practical research. I think we should leave it as a warning that for China's government and authority to take a more effective, more prudent policy to governing our the financial sections. Because as we know that the Fitch has a very special methodology, the method to make the OIS research, always have some differences with the other countries, not only with China, but with the other countries also have the similar questions. So that's why I think this is a good chance for Chinese government to see what from the Fitch they look at the China's fiscal policy, what we should need more to improve our management from policy making and from the implementation of this policy. Anyhow, I think, in my opinion, we don't take too much care about the such rating, but we should pay great attention how to improve our policy making and policy implementation in the future.
Yes, but also we noted that Fitch mentioned contingent liability risks from hidden debts like local government financing vehicles. I mean, how big of a challenge are these hidden debts for China's financial stability, and what steps is the government taking to address them?
Yeah, this question is very interesting. In my memory, I think such a question regarding the contingent liability risks and also the hidden debt about China already at least 10 years and 15 years before. Some Western media, Western rating companies have such questions on China. And also based on this one side research, they always try to not to stigmatize, but try to blacklist the China's financial sections reform. So this is something that we need more efforts to explain to the world that what's really happening in China, what's the real fiscal policy of our Ministry of Finance, and what we have done before to avoid any possible contingent liability risk. So in this way, that make the world much better understanding about China. So in this way, in my opinion, the government has many steps or the opportunities to upgrade our fiscal policies. For instance, how to manage, how to monitor, how to control the government debt, and also how to control all this government issued the national bond or guaranteed by the local government. In this way, that we can do much better job to control all this contingent liability, especially for so-called hidden debt. So in this way, that we always try to say what debt belongs to hidden, how to define this. There's no good solution in the world. So we should pay attention to our actual situation and the conditions in China.
Okay, and also China's Ministry of Finance said keeping the deficit ratio at 3% in 2024 is generally moderate and reasonable. So how does China define reasonable in terms of the deficit level, and how does this balance the need for economic growth with controlling debt?
When we're talking about this reasonable result or reasonable policy, we always try to define this decision or any policy based on the good reason. For instance, the 3% of deficit for China, for the so huge, larger country, second largest the world economy. So any people or in some experts in America, in European countries, they always try to tell me you see that China for such a big country, if you have even more than 4 or 5% of deficit is normal. There's nothing to worry. But China has always a very prudent policy that in order to avoid any hidden risk, hidden challenges. So this is one thing that just our government paid great attention and tried to monitor and manage it in the right way. So that's why the 3% deficit, we called it very reasonable. This because this is within our capability to control it, to see what could be happening, what the negative impact on the economic overall situation. So this is the main reason we see that this figure is reasonable for us, because we can deal with it. We can confront it with this this deficit in China. So we hope that in order to make this deficit in the right position, that to promote our economy, because with this limited deficit, the local government has some more capability and ability to raise funds in the market that could be used to stimulate and to promote the local economic development, even for more investment for some urgent projects in local needs. So this is a very great and positive policy for the government to follow up.
Well, we know that China's economy grew by 5.2% in 2023. How does that compare to other major economies? And what are the biggest factors that will determine whether China meets its growth target of around 5% this year?
Yeah, that's a good question. As we know, compared to other so-called advanced countries or major countries in the West, the America, the European countries, I think China's 5.2% is really very satisfactory result, and much better than expected. This is true. The United States last year is only less than 3%. I think the last number is 3.1%, and the European countries only 2.1 or 2.3%. Even in Germany, it's negative. There are no growth. So I think compared to the major countries, China's 5.2% is much, much better than all these major countries, because of our economy's really resilient and with greater potential, and also very dynamic for the future. So this is why we can very be relaxing that we set up our new target for 5% for this year. 5% is already conservative, because we have some efforts, some good tendency that reserved for the future. For instance, more than 5% is also possible. Some experts said 5.2% or 3% for this year is very possible. But for the national target, we're still very, very prudent with some conservation. That is also good, give us more freedom and more space to for these challenges.
Yeah, and very briefly, do you think this downgrade is going to impact China's ability to raise capital, or the will it have an impact on China's economy?
Yeah, according to the experience in the financial market, especially in the international open market or second-hand market, I think that such a rating would not have great damage on China's China sovereignty, the debt, the reputation, because in short term, it could have some negative only within 3 months, I think, not longer. But in long term, I think it will change the whole outlook of the China's economic development. So it will come back to the real situation, because China's credibility is very unique in the world. Nobody can magnify of this fact. So I think we don't need to worry about this.
Okay, thank you, Liu Zhiqin, Senior Fellow of Chongyang Institute for Financial Studies at Renmin University of China. Coming up, EU to investigate Chinese wind turbine suppliers, and UK employees now have the right to request flexible work from day one. You're listening to World Today. Stay with us. Well, you're listening to World Today. I'm Zhao Ying. The European Union has launched a subsidy investigation into Chinese wind turbine companies. The probe will look into the development of wind farms in Spain, Greece, France, Romania, and Bulgaria. The investigation will use the European Commission's new power design to clamp down on market-distorting foreign subsidies. The announcement of the move came days after the Commission opened a separate probe into Chinese companies bidding for a solar farm contract in Romania. In response, China's foreign ministry on Wednesday vowed to safeguard the legitimate interests of Chinese companies, saying China is concerned about perceived rise in protectionism in the EU. The China Chamber of Commerce to the EU has also criticized the latest action for discriminating against Chinese enterprises, suggesting it sends a detrimental signal to the world. Joining us now in the studio is my colleague Ding Heng. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, Zhao Ying.
So what do you think is the sentiment that has prompted the EU to launch this investigation?
Ultimately, I think it is a sentiment that we, the EU, has lagged behind China in terms of wind power, etc., and the resulting fear or dissatisfaction. China overtook the EU in 2020 as the major or the biggest maker of wind power installations. And nowadays, China accounts for more than half of the global wind turbines in operation. What we have heard from Margaret Vestager is that EU can't afford to see what happened on solar panels happening once again on wind and electric vehicles. Because in the case of the solar panel, Europe was actually once the global leader. In 2007, 30% of all solar panels across the world at the time were produced by European countries. But nowadays, China's global share in every stage of the solar power supply chain is above 80%. Why is that? I would argue that's largely because the EU has lagged behind China in terms of vision, because China has invested more than $50 billion in new solar panel manufacturing capacity since the year 2011, basically 10 times the amount invested in Europe over the same period. And then with regard to wind turbine and wind power generation, there has been a similar trend. So I guess losing a competitive advantage that Europe once enjoyed to China nowadays is something that many European politicians might find it difficult to accept.
Okay, well, regarding this, the new powers of the European Commission here, we are talking about a tool called the Foreign Subsidies Regulation, which took effect last year. And it was deployed in February to Chinese rolling stock manufacturer CRRC's bid to supply trains in Bulgaria, forcing CRRC to withdraw from the bid. What is your observation of this tool, and is there anything controversial about it?
Yeah, so this regulation is known as FSR in short, requiring companies to notify and seek approval from the European Commission if a non-EU government provides financial contributions to a business operation or a certain investment project. The stated purpose is, of course, to fend off the so-called unfair advantages against EU companies, but I think one problem seems to be the definition of this idea of financial contributions is actually very, very broad, including grants, export subsidies, and tax credits, etc., etc. And I think this kind of situation has really created a lot of confusion or uncertainty for the business community, because the notification process would really involve a wide range of many specific and detailed questions. And during the first 100 days of the FSR, the European Commission ended up receiving a much greater than expected number of merger and acquisition notifications, which really means that there will be mounting workloads and work capacity for both European Union bureaucrats and the businesses. So a widely perceived complaint about the EU, as we understand, is already regarding its perceived bureaucracy. And I think initiatives like the FSR are only reinforcing the sense of bureaucracy. And then I think common sense would tell us that over the long term, this could be really detrimental to the investment or business opportunity or business environment over there in the EU.
Well, according to a report released last year by a US-based NGO called Global Energy Monitor, 7 out of the top 10 wind turbine manufacturers in the world today are Chinese companies. But do you think China's competitive advantage in the wind power, or more broadly in green technologies, are simply a result of government subsidies?
I think it's too simplistic to put it that way. It's actually a combination of government policy support and then corporate level innovations as well. In the realm of wind power, China actually entirely depended on imported wind turbines before 2005. Then between 2005 and 2010, there was a government policy by the central authority that encouraged investment, including foreign investment, in China's domestic wind turbine manufacturing capacity. Of course, we don't deny there were subsidies, but subsidies were really only part of the bigger policy support. And then I think some characteristics, unique characteristics, I would say, in China's political system also proved to be quite helpful, like this long-term planning and a relatively collaborative relationship between central and regional governments. Because in China, provincial or regional governments can really mobilize a lot of supporting resources to really achieve a target regionally that is in line with a national goal set by the central government. By comparison, there are more divisions or disagreements between the EU and some individual EU member states, that's for sure. But I think in addition to policy support, let's really not underestimate the capacity of innovations on the part of Chinese corporations as well, which have really significantly driven down costs of wind turbines and solar panels, etc. As a matter of fact, China abolished the subsidies for the majority of any newly launched wind or solar projects starting in the year 2021. So the current dynamics in these industries are really largely driven by market forces.
Yeah, and at the end of the day, we know that green technologies, including wind turbines, are about efforts to cope with climate change. And we know that the EU, the US, has long pressured China to do more on climate efforts. But how do you look at their increasing restrictions against green technologies from China?
Yeah, I think if we think about these two things, they're really self-contradictory with each other. There is really a sense of irony here. I mean, what can China really do to cope with the climate change? It's by no means slogans alone. Political determination is important, but we also need to translate that determination, that willingness, into real industrial actions and technological progress, etc. In the case of the EV, electric vehicle, which is also a target by the European Union investigators, according to the data released by Chinese government, all the EVs on China's roads can reduce a total of 15 million tons of carbon emissions on annual basis. By some estimate, you really need to plant more than 2.9 billion trees in order to achieve the same kind of effect in terms of carbon emissions reduction. So restricting China's green technology is really no good idea. Between the EU and China, there is really a big room for cooperation, coordination, collaboration, and supplementing each other. So I think with that in mind, the latest EU action we are talking about here and other actions targeting Chinese EVs and solar panels, etc., will only make things more complicated and confrontational.
Yeah, thank you, Dinghong. The U.S. economy added 303,000 jobs in March, well above expectations. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, unemployment rate fell to 3.8% from 3.9% in February. Meanwhile, wage growth has declined to an annual 4.1% in March. What does the latest figures say about the U.S. job market? Which sectors added more jobs? And what does it say about Federal Reserve's future interest rate cuts? For more on this, my colleague Zhao Yang spoke with Einar Tangen, senior fellow at the Taihe Institute.
So first, how do you read the U.S. job figures in March? And what does it tell us about the job market and the economy?
Well, there's a few things that you need to know about the job market in the United States. I mean, the figures look terrific. They look like a country that's really kind of doing very, very well. But you have to dig a little bit deeper. The absolute number of jobs out there is actually less than in 2022 and 2023. It's higher than some, but it's kind of at a midpoint. So the number of people working full time is not as high as it looks. And you can find that in the job statistics. However, the number of people working more than one job is continuing to increase. And people also have to be aware that the way they calculate a full-time employee is if you work more than 35 hours or more. But a part-time employee is just all you have to do is work 1 hour up to 34 hours and you're considered part-time. And the number of part-time employees has increased, obviously. So the statistics aren't as great. The other thing that's a little bit worrisome is that credit card debt continues to grow, and that is affecting retail sales. Remember, employment is related to business, which is related to sales. If your sales are not going to look good, and right now the estimates are almost a full point below retail sales in 2023, expected for 2024. If that happens, you could see some people being let go simply because they're not earning the revenue that's needed. Also, the credit card debt is really hitting hard. There's a lot of delinquencies in car loans, mortgages, credit card debt, personal loans, etc. So it looks really good. It looks like the Fed is managing things, but it doesn't. There are some worrying signs underneath.
Mm, interesting. So which sectors create more jobs in the U.S.? And it has not been that great news for every single sector. We know that the tech industry has taken a hit. In fact, Apple announced it will lay off about 600 employees as it gives up its EV ambitions. And big name companies like IBM, like Microsoft and Amazon, they all have announced the plans for cuts this year. So how do you explain it? And how do you view this layoff, and what does it tell us about the economy?
Well, there's a global issues that are going on. I mean, the demand is down across the board, and that looks, at least from the American side and also European side, to be continued to be soft this year. So this will impact the entire world. In terms of the jobs that are out there, surprisingly, government was number two, healthcare number one. But, you see the shift away from companies that can add in the sense that they create new products and services. There's good payment for them if you're in the tech industry. And those are jobs are very, very well paid. And you see it shifting to jobs that they don't really have come with a productivity number. You know, you add more people to government, your productivity does not rise. You add more people to, hospitals, your productivity does not rise. So you have an increase in non-productive employment, a decrease in productive employment. And this, as a trend, is very worrisome because at some point you just can't afford to pay all these extra people. Or if you do, you're going to add further to your massive deficit.
Mm. And how does this job report impact the inflationary pressure in the U.S. and the thinking of the U.S. Federal Reserve moving forward on the possible rate cuts?
Well, the inflation numbers weren't great. They're still well above the 2% that the Fed wants. This is leading the market to believe that there will be two rate cuts instead of three. But, in terms of overall, People are using this to encourage confidence within the United States. It's very important. Remember, the vitality of most countries, and China included, is based on the confidence of small, medium-sized business entities, their willingness to invest, hire more people. Of course, that creates this virtuous upward cycle where more people have money and therefore they spend more. So it's kind of self-fulfilling if it works. So they're working on the confidence angle, but the underlying parts are not as strong as it looks. Inflation will continue to be a higher number. As I said, you're adding a lot of jobs that have no productivity connected to them. They're simply additive services, transfer payments, et cetera, versus productive things, which are actually going down, as we've seen in many industries. I think construction is a bright point. I should add that in. That is very hopeful. But the number of new houses being created, it's going to depend a lot on the rates, because if the rates are high, people can't afford to buy it.
Mm. And after the job report, the Fed swaps shows that the first rate cut has been pushed further down the road. And it may come in September, not in June or July. And speculation that there could be no rate cut this year has also been growing. So how likely will that happen? And if so, how will it affect ordinary people's life in the U.S.?
Well, I mean, everyone assumes that the Fed will continue with its kind of inflation fight. But at some point, if the economy does turn negative and it becomes extremely weak, there'll be pressure on the Fed to say, look, we have to switch to a stimulus. Otherwise, you're throwing the baby out with the bathwater. You might get no inflation, but there'll be no business. And that would seriously hurt that would reverse the figures, especially in employment. You'd see an upswing in terms of delinquencies, even above where they are now. So the Fed is not just one thing. I mean, they really try to manage the entire U.S. economy with just these kind of rate increases and rate cuts. It's kind of, one person described to me as trying to use a scalpel to butcher a cow. It is not a big tool. It's a very fine tool. It works well when you're managing, situations which, can go up and down, during a period of expansion. It can be very, very useful in terms of managing demand and things like this, but it's just not the tool that you need when you're looking at a kind of paradigm shift.
And how would it impact the global capital market? All eyes are on the Federal Reserve, and speculation swirls as to when the U.S. Central Bank will loosen the monetary policy. So how will that translate into something on the global capital market?
Well, I mean, hot money flows will continue to flow into the United States. The attractiveness of U.S. Treasury bonds in terms of yield is still there. But, that cuts against the U.S. government because they're the ones who are paying that interest. And in essence, they have been borrowing for years to pay the interest on the loans that they've had before while, borrowing additional monies. So this isn't a good sign from that perspective. And the question is, who's going to buy these bonds? If they're not bought, then they have to be bought. In essence, they're just printed money. And there are questions about what kind of inflationary effects that would have. So globally, you still see money tilting towards the U.S., except on the private side. Central banks have kind of pulled back from that. They have their lowest levels since 2011 in terms of U.S. Treasury holdings, and they're holding a lot more gold, and they're doing trade in local currencies. So, as we've discussed, there's a real sea change happening in that area. It's not ready yet, but certainly there is a time when the U.S. will not be the dominant currency. It will simply be a currency that people use in international trade markets. Of course, the rates staying higher, the dollar remains stronger. And that affects any kind of country that has a dollar-denominated loan. This is, as I said, very difficult times. So there's a cash crunch on for a lot of these countries. And it's a question of how they're going to get through without defaulting on these loans in U.S. dollar terms.
Einar Tengen, Senior Fellow at the Taihe Institute, speaking with my colleague Zhao Yang. This is World Today. We'll be back. This is World Today. I'm Zhao Ying. A new British law means that employees now have a legal right to request flexible working from their first day in a job. This could include requests for remote working, staggered hours, or job sharing. Previously, the right was only applicable if someone had worked for their employer for 26 weeks or more. For more, we are joined by Duncan Bartlett, a journalist and political analyst at University of London. Duncan, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me on the program again.
So what exactly are the main reasons behind this legislation?
Well, a lot of my friends say that having some flexibility around the times that they work is extremely important to them. And in addition to choosing the hours they work, they also want to be able to choose where they work. So when I talk to students at the University of London and I ask them what kind of job they want to do when they graduate, they often say that for young people, flexible working practices are very important. And in fact, they may well be key factors in terms of recruiting young people.
Yeah.
And it's not just young people, because flexible working can obviously bring a lot of benefits to people who have health conditions, or indeed those people who've got responsibility for caring for a child or an elderly relative.
Yes, you mentioned this interesting situation in the UK. Actually, it is estimated that about 2 million people in your country quit their jobs every year over the lack of flexibility. While flexibility-related perks are what over 50% of the people looking for a new job are in search of. So why do people in the UK care so much about working flexibility?
Well, that's a good question. And let me reply with a story. There's an ongoing rail strike in the UK, and in London on Monday, there were almost no commuter trains running at all. So a lot of people decided to work from home instead. I went to one of the big stations in London and it was almost deserted. Now, if you've got flexible working arrangements, which allows you to work from home, that's a big help. And again, you can think about this from the perspective of parents or carers. It's a great help if you've got flexible working arrangements, if you have kids. And the other point is that Britain has an aging population, so there are actually rising levels of economically inactive people, partly due to ill health. So the hope is that the flexible working will improve people's general well-being and ensure that they're happy in their jobs. So in that sense, it could be good for society.
Okay, so do you think this new law is going to significantly change the UK workplace?
Well, I think it already has changed, actually, as a result of the pandemic. Many of us got used to working from home during the lockdowns. I'm working from home today, but that doesn't prevent me from talking to people from all over the world. What's intriguing is that the Office for National Statistics in Britain says that about 16% of the workforce still haven't returned to the workplace since the pandemic. And I think for many of us, working from home has helped us to appreciate the value of flexible working. But it's not always easy. I don't always thrive from working from home myself.
Yes, but how do you think this new law will affect businesses or employers in the UK? Because some worry about potential negative impacts on productivity, while others highlight benefits like talent retention and improved morale. What is your idea?
Well, some employers are definitely not happy about it. They say they can't allow people to work flexibly because it's going to increase their costs and it'll damage their business. So in some situations, work can't be reorganized among other staff. You know, it's often the case that a person has a unique role, and if they're absent, that has a bad impact on the team that they work with. But, you know, on the whole, the British government supports these more flexible working rules. The government says these are measures which should make for a happier workforce, which means increased productivity.
Yes. So as you said, the government actually hopes the new law will boost productivity. But how is that going to work? And what do you make of this long-term impact on UK's economy?
Well, I think it's all about organizing and managing time better, actually. And I think that's a lesson that's true for those of us who work from home, and it's also true for people who work in teams. Are we using our time effectively? Is the teamwork good? Are we getting caught up with too many meetings or replying to too many emails? I mean, these are all factors that come into play. It's not just about the hours that one's in the office. It's about what one does with one's time that has a key impact on productivity.
Well, do you think similar legislation could be adopted perhaps in other countries as well? Are there global trends that suggest a move towards some more flexible working arrangements?
Well, that's a good question. And as you're in Beijing and we're talking on China Radio International, let's consider the situation in China. Now, it's a well-known fact that white-collar workers in China routinely put in very long hours, and some tech companies are rather notorious for their so-called 996 schedule, by which employees work from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. 6 days a week. Well, I know that's only a minority of companies in China, but it sounds like a pretty arduous system. I don't want to work that way, and I'm sure you don't want to work that way either. The point, I think, is quite a serious one, that if you have this long hours culture, that is okay for younger employees, but what about those people who've got kids to look after, or they've got responsibilities for their elderly parents? You know, China has an aging population. Again, I can tell from the conversations that I'm having with Chinese students in London that some of them are wondering, actually, what kind of working life they'll face when they go back to China. But I saw an interesting report on CCTV the other day, which featured a young couple with college degrees, and they were saying that they're making about 9,000 yuan, 9,000 renminbi each night as street food vendors. They're selling tofu in a market in Zhejiang province in the east of China. And this couple was saying, look, we have to work in the evening, but we don't have to work particularly long shifts. And it sounded to me as though they were having more fun on the market than they would have done in the office. So I'm sure it's hard work running a street stall, selling tofu, but for some people, that's a more appealing job than working as a clerk in a bank or as a teacher in a university.
Yes, indeed. Thank you, Duncan Bartlett, a journalist and political analyst at the University of London. Thank you. And that's all the time we have for this edition of World Today. I'm Zhao Ying. Thank you so much for listening. See you next time.